Most haunted hospitals hold dark and eerie pasts and have always been a source of fascination for both historians and paranormal enthusiasts alike. Once hustling and bustling entities turned silent and dark, with only the whispers of their past now alive and echoing from their halls. Today, I'll be telling you about three of these locations, three of the spookiest hospitals in the country. One that stands abandoned, left to the nature and elements to let time take its course. One that was demolished and now only the basement survives, under a playground at a park, nonetheless. And one that is actually still in action. And at 141 years old, it's the oldest operating hospital in Oregon. This is the spooky space of Greenville Tuberculosis Hospital, the Mansfield Training School and Hospital, and the Oregon State Hospital. Is located at 126 Beverly Road in Greenville, South Carolina. It spans 17 acres and consists of walking trails, multi-purpose athletic fields, volleyball courts, horseshoe courts, shelter rentals for picnics with tables and a gazebo, and a playground. With panoramic views of downtown Greenville and Paris Mountain, it is a true sight to be seen. And it was even voted one of the top playgrounds by Kidding Around Greenville. There's a lot of conflicting energy in the area, as its spacious fields are filled with laughter, joy, and fun during the day. But as the light diminishes and the shadows grow, it becomes an eerie, foreboding, and looming location. The playground is your typical playground with slides, swings, and monkey bars. It was opened in 2007, built on the site of the sprawling three-floor Greenville Tuberculosis Hospital, also known as Hopewell, where hundreds of patients afflicted with tuberculosis were treated from the 1930s to the 1950s. And since there wasn't really a cure until around the time it closed, most of the patients were essentially quarantined until they succumbed to the illness. No one knows the exact toll of death, but the area is a known, very well-known hotspot for paranormal activity. Now, when the hospital closed in the 1950s, the building sat abandoned until 2002, when a mysterious fire broke out, burning down most of the building. The rest was just demolished. And while the hospital may be gone, the eerie sounds and shadows still linger. Visitors to the park report hearing eerie sounds, screams of agony, sobs, and a bell ringing when there's no bell around the area. People who have been on the playground that sits just above the basement reported hearing banging, footsteps that sound as if someone's running down an empty hallway, disembodied voices, and items at the park move on their own. Now, those who live nearby have said that they've seen apparitions appear and disappear, orbs flying around, and shadowy figures wandering around the park and even into nearby homes. There are mysterious puddles located near the memorial bench that turn red when it rains, and that bench is located near the former morgue. Now, as I mentioned before, the basement still sits fully intact under that playground. The door is fully visible, although it's been sealed off, obviously for safety reasons, so nobody can get in there. And the original stone actually surrounds it. A plaque next to the stone sign tells of the hospital's history. Now, before it was burned down, people who visited the building would have a feeling of being pushed when they were on the third floor. It was also a psychiatric hospital for the criminally insane at one point and a prisoner release site at another. Throughout the area, in the more secluded and wooded areas, there's more original foundation that's overgrown with plants and trees. In 2008, Jason Proffitt from Modern Mind Reader walked around the sanatorium grounds asking if anyone was still around, planning that if there were spirits and he got a response, he would do an investigation. When they returned to the car about 10 minutes later, the headlights were on, and they know, the two people who were there know for sure that they turned them off. He said that this was a sign that something was reaching out. The recording he took where the old lobby would have stood, and in the background you can actually hear lots of banging, chatter, as if multiple people are moving around and having conversation, and you can actually hear a few cries here and there. The main entry steps are those that now lead to the playground. So, would you visit these haunted grounds? Have you visited these haunted grounds? I'd love to hear your story, and if you have, leave it in the comments. Our next visit in our haunted hospitals journey today is the Mansfield Training School and Hospital in Mansfield, Connecticut. Now, University of Connecticut, home of the Huskies. I'm not really into sports. I just feel like people get really excited about their sports teams. This one is actually one of the oldest universities in the country, with one of the largest public research connections in the state and one of the largest libraries in New England. I'm already sold on visiting before we even get into the spooky and the creepy. Now, this mysterious institution is whispered about as if people are a little too frightened to speak about what went on and still goes on above a certain level. Now, founded in 1860 by Samuel Gridley Howe and his wife Julia Ward Howe, it was built for those with developmental disabilities to provide specialized education and offer work training. Originally called Connecticut School for Imbeciles, it kept the undesirables out of sight and out of mind in a remote location, until around 1950, when the name was said to be found offensive, it was then retitled Connecticut Training School for the Feeble-Minded, because that's so much better. Now, the school then merged with the Connecticut Colony for Epileptics in 1917, and this institution actually helped epileptics and those with physical and mental impairments. It was the ideal place. It was an isolated 350-acre campus that became the Mansfield Training School and Hospital when all was said and done. It started off with 402 patients who were given an education and also taught gardening, carpentry, and farming. There was a small farm that offered these occupational therapies and provided food for everyone. When the Great Depression hit and World War II broke out, the patient numbers began to rise. Over its 60-year lifespan, over 1,800 patients were in attendance throughout 50 buildings, which, that's quite a campus. Now, a lot of folks say it had a dedicated and caring staff and a good reputation. However, a much larger portion of folks say that the patients lived in poor conditions and dealt with abuse, and that it showed the approach of no compassion or understanding for those going through these mental and physical disabilities. In 1987, it was added to the National Register of Historical Places, and after many lawsuits and concerns about what was going on, it closed in 1993. This was also when large facilities were kind of starting to become a little more obsolete and the smaller community-driven care was becoming more popular and more widely used. Some of the buildings were demolished and some became part of University of Connecticut's Depot campus. It also became the Berlin Correctional Center, which was a minimum security facility for male offenders. Now, the building known as the Night Hospital is nothing but a tomb of its former self. It's eerie, derelict, and overgrown with the beautiful nature that has taken over. And it's sad because, as you can see from the photos, this building is actually quite just, it's beautiful. I love the brick look. I love that Greek style that it has with the columns. It's just, to me, I think the building is still actually pretty. Now, reports of spirit mists, orbs, voices, sounds, shapes, and apparitions run high. It's located on Route 44, and somebody who actually visited recently says that the doors are all locked, which I'm pretty sure is also another one of those safety things because the buildings just aren't being kept up, so you never know what is safe to go into or what could crumble at any moment. Now, some who attended the school say that there's a building with an observation room that looks into multiple rooms with padded walls and manacles, and the doors have knobs on the outside only. There's also rooms with old equipment and even patient records strewn about, but it's in such bad shape and unsafe to enter that those records are basically deemed lost forever. Now, people explain that there was a grading system that was used, and you were either high grade, low grade, or dope as a way to measure if they were suitable for working and what they could or couldn't do. Now, lawsuits claim that patients were found wearing no clothes, they were not bathed properly or often. And some of them had to deal with the tasks that the staff didn't want to do, like taking care of human waste, or even taking care of each other, which was probably why they weren't clothed and bathed properly. When the Spanish flu hit, 200 out of the 300 patients at the time were affected, and it resulted in 30 deaths. And there was only one doctor and one nurse in charge of taking care of all of these patients. Like most historical buildings, the hospital is full of paranormal activity. Reports of unexplained footsteps and empty corridors, ghostly apparitions, screams, and voices beckoning you from the darkness are heard. Building 16 seems to hold the most activity. There's cold spots, footsteps, and quite a few shadowy figures that have been reported. But it's no surprise once you hear of the mistreatment, sorrow, and heartbreak that went on in the hospital. Now, this wasn't just your typical patients go in and typical patients go out when they felt they could survive on their own. People were actually put here and just left, forgotten by family members, forgotten by friends, forgotten by their community, and because they were ashamed of them. Unwed mothers-to-be were sent here and until they had the baby, and then their babies were taken from them to hide the shame that they brought to their family. But some of those women weren't released after the birth. Some of them were kept there under the explanation that they weren't mentally stable to be released back into society. And there's also no real way to track where these children went. So that's also really sad that it's just kind of, I don't want to say they're just lost to the Neverlands, but, you know, if I were an unwed mother and I was forced basically to give my child up, like against my will, I would want to know if that child was okay, at least. Now, there's a story about a young child who was murdered, but I wasn't really able to find anything on this. Paranormal investigators say that they have asked about the incidents and they received the name Jessica. But once again, a lot of the records were lost forever. So I couldn't find anything. And I even like kind of searched it using the name. And you get like a couple of things here and there, but there's also a lot of conflicting. Like a lot of people say that that's just a made up story. Some people say that they've heard from family members who lived there back in the day, who are no longer around, conveniently, that it actually happened, but I couldn't find anything. So that's a memory, or not a memory, but that's a mystery that I will now think about for the rest of my life and wonder what happened. Now, patients reported being kept in the basement wearing nothing but diapers. You can hear crying, laughter, and conversations throughout the empty hallways. There's a cemetery that was used by the hospital where some say the spirits still linger. And one lawsuit from a Gladys Burr is highly unsettling. Now, Gladys was just 29 when her family brought her to the hospital, claiming that she was psychotic and mentally retarded. Now, I hate using that word, but I kind of wanted to get the impact of what her family did to her kind of across. She lived at home and had a hard time finding employment. Now, there was nothing wrong with her. It was just kind of around that time where jobs were scarce, but her family just didn't want to have to basically care for her anymore. They just didn't want to have her around. I mean, put her to work cleaning and taking care of the house if it's that much of a problem. Now, in the 1940s, she requested to be released, but her family didn't want her back, so she was basically kept against her will to live in a place where she said she was beaten on a regular basis, fed only bread and water, and forced to work overnights in the laundry room, while being one of those patients who took on the responsibilities of the nursing staff that just didn't want to do their own work. They should have given her a job at the hospital. Now, she was also forced to help lift other patients that were quite larger than her, and she was only about 85 pounds during most of the time that she was there. So she was not, I mean, she was tiny. Like, 85 pounds is little, you know, especially for a grown woman. Now, I'm not body shaming. I'm just saying that if you're 85 pounds as a grown woman, you're a small statured woman. Like myself, I'm 120 pounds and I'm also, you know, on the smaller stature side. But I can only imagine an 85 pound person who hasn't had much work experience trying to lift me as dead weight. Now, Gladys, actually told how she and other patients weren't paid or compensated in any way for their work, and said that the patients were basically subjected to slavery, and when they didn't work, they were punished. In 1961, she was moved to a different facility, which was a better facility, but she was still being kept against her will and against her begging and pleading to leave. At this time, she was 54 years old. In 1968, she wrote a letter asking to leave, and they claim that this is the first and only time she ever asked, but her lawyers had proof that she had requested multiple times to be let out. In 1978, she was finally released and filed a $1.2 million lawsuit. However, she was only awarded $235,000. Now, can you imagine being locked up for 42 years of your life, left by your family, subjected to beatings, barely eating, forced therapies, being held in a straitjacket, working for nothing, barely being fed? Just, can you imagine? $235,000, that's all you're worth. Okay. Thank you for 42 years of your life. She also told how patients were subjected to electroshock therapy, lobotomies, and they were even putting DNRs, which are do not resuscitate, on patients who weren't requesting them. So if you coded, you were just gone. There was no trying to bring you back. There was no effort made for you at all. There was murder, there was suicide, and there were injuries from treatments basically forced upon these patients throughout the hospital. Gladys passed away in 1989 at the age of 82, and she lived most of her life in hell just because her family didn't want to deal with her. And it was easy to just take you and dump you off back then, too. Now, honestly, how sad is that? On an episode of Paranormal Witness, the Mansfield Mansion, which actually sits on the grounds, was the star of one episode. Now, Amy Moore noticed the home one day. She was going through a divorce and she was kind of looking for a new start. And she was quite the, you know, fixer-upper project home, but it was going for a decent price. So her and her daughter, Alyssa, moved in. Alyssa said that she had an unsettling feeling from the very beginning. And the first time she visited the home, a cold gust of air engulfed her, and she heard like what sounded like heavy breathing just like right on top of her. And she actually ran out of the house. She was like, no, she maneuvered it right out. Now, another day, Alyssa was home alone and she heard moaning coming from her mother's bedroom. And she thought that maybe her mother had hurt herself because Amy was doing the renovations on the home herself. So she was going to check to make sure she was okay. But then she remembered that Amy had left for work earlier that morning and she hadn't returned home yet. So once again, Alyssa fled the house. Now, like I said, Amy was doing the renovations herself, and the third floor, when they first opened it up, still had dressers, it had old beds, there was a wheelchair or two, and the basement was said to have had cremated remains. Now, this wouldn't have been, you know, a surprise or uncommon, because a lot of hospitals, when you're just left, a lot of the bodies of the dead are cremated and the remains are kept basically on site. That's if the family doesn't claim them, but a lot of families didn't claim back then. There's also an old tunnel system that has been partially closed off that runs underneath the different just buildings. So I'm sure one led to that mansion if it was being used during the time the hospital was in operation. She told how the door to the third floor would open on its own. She would be up there doing something, then she would close it, she would latch the door, and just a few minutes later, she'd be passing by again, and it would be standing wide open. Now, one day, she was up on a ladder doing some work on the home, and she cut herself, and she suddenly felt pushed and fell off the ladder. And when she went down, she actually heard heavy footsteps running through the room as if somebody had basically pushed her and ran, like out the door. Now, the next day, there would be no sign of anything, but only to have occurrences return just a few days later. She explained having nightmares and items moving on their own and a random growling that would just come out of nowhere. So her friend Dave McGann, who was going through a divorce, actually came to stay at the home, and he told the story that he was home by himself one time when he saw a shadow apparition that manifested before him and then just disappeared. It seems though the patients are long gone, a presence still lurks. Now, our final stop on our journey of haunted hospitals, for this episode anyway, we'll be visiting the Oregon State Hospital. It opened its doors in 1883 as the Oregon State Insane Asylum, and it was the only mental institution in the state at this time. Now, it was sitting on 92 acres, and it's actually the hospital used in the 1975 movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, starring Jack Nicholson. I actually just watched that movie for the first time recently, and I actually really enjoyed it. Not to get off topic, but sometimes I just go on my rants. But it's a great movie. I think you should check it out. It's got Danny DeVito in it. Didn't even realize it was Danny DeVito. But yeah. So it was built under the Kirkbride plan, which if you've tuned into my past episodes about haunted hospitals, I've explained his ideology against the stuffy, dark, dungeon-type facilities. He would actually build these sprawling, more wider kind of, I don't want to say zigzag, but it was like they would, I got to find the right word for that, but they'd be longer and kind of, anyway. He would include plenty of sunlight. He actually pioneered changes in the way that mental health was approached because he believed that fresh air, peaceful locations, nature, and sunshine helped. And it actually seemed to prove true. The Oregon State Hospital was well known for healing and recovery. Except only as time went on, whispers of abuse and mistreatment began to spread. Now, at 141 years old, this hospital is actually still operating and is the oldest in the state. Reports began to come out that they used harsh techniques as ways to treat patients. The stigma, ignorance, and just flat-out lack of caring caused for barbaric treatments. Now, electroshock therapy, this is a treatment that takes 70 to 120 volts, and it would be administered directly to the patient's temple, causing generalized seizures, and they felt that this kind of calmed you down and, you know, made you more docile, and it did, because it basically just electrocuted you into, and it's like getting tased. I've never been tased, but I can only imagine. They also did the lobotomy, and this is where they would take that ice pick or that, you know, that a sharp object, and they would pop it right into the socket where it would sever the connections in the brain's prefrontal cortex. And this just basically made you a shell of yourself if you even survived it. There was a very high death rate with lobotomies. They also used eugenics in their practice, and this actually consists of altering the human gene pool, and they would basically exclude people they felt shouldn't procreate. It was sort of a scientific racism, and they forced sterilization on people. In 1931, they sterilized 131 people alone. Hydrotherapy, they would force people into extremely hot or ice cold water for pain relief or treatment. They used solitary confinement and straitjackets for those who got out of hand. Also, their cure for hysteria was hysterectomies. Now, keep in mind, your husband, ladies, let me tell you this. Your husband could take you and dump you in this facility and be done with you for being too mouthy. I'd be in trouble, too frigid towards him, or even too sexual towards him. And they could then just give you a hysterectomy, cut all those organs right out of you to calm you down and make you better. Also, men, you can't have it both ways. How do you sit here and complain, my wife never wants to do anything anymore, but then she's doing too much and now you have to get over yourselves. Patients were chained in the dark. They were chained in dirty cells. They had portions of their skull removed and they were forced to vomit and had regular bloodletting to try to cure them of their disease. And this is where I say, like, there was just so much ignorance that was around at this time that they would do these things thinking that, oh, this will make people better. Let's just bloodlet them. Let's make them vomit. Let's electrocute them. Now, a lot of Native Americans were actually admitted to the hospital for talking to their ancestors. And the thing is, if they couldn't speak English to, like, let people know, hey, I'm good, they were just dumped there just for no reason. Some patients were just malnourished and they actually were released once they were kind of brought back up to health. So they were some lucky ones that got out. Now, I actually saw a post on Reddit where one comment stated that the person's mother was a patient in the mid-1970s where she was admitted for postpartum depression. They didn't know much about postpartum depression, so, you know, they didn't really know how to treat it or what was going on? Well, they used shock therapy to help treat this. And she actually claimed and told the story about being sexually assaulted by an orderly. Another comment on that same thread spoke about how the commenter's older sister was admitted. Her parents said she was somewhat of a wild child back in the 1970s, and so they took her in to get her straight. And they also used shock therapy to treat her, and she was also sexually assaulted by an orderly. And I kind of wonder if it was the same orderly, because this happened in the 1970s, so it was kind of the same time frame. So, now, people of all walks of life ended up in the institution. Jewett Williams Journey from Maine, who actually served in the Union in the Civil War from 1864 to 1865. He ended up here. He had no family, and when he passed, he was cremated in 1922. And they actually recently did I don't know if they do it every year. I just saw the one article that they did a ceremony. They take his cremains, and they had like a flag over it and played some music for him. And I actually thought that was actually really nice. Now, reform came about in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and while most patients were guilty of crimes, like I said, back then you could be admitted to the mental facility for anything, for ADD, ADHD, OCD, autism, being neurodivergent, mental health trauma, alcoholism, dementia, tuberculosis. And because there wasn't a lot of research and a lot of information at the time as to what really caused, you know, people thought that you were just disabled. There was grotesque abuse, and there were underground tunnels that were used to transport the more troublesome patients, the dead bodies, food, laundry. Some would sneak down there to have sex because it was forbidden to be doing that in their rooms. But it also housed cells where they would perform experiments on the patients, and the staff would help to conceal their screams. Now, as time went on and more patients were being admitted, there was severe overcrowding, and many died in the hospital, most of them alone. And one patient was in his bed for hours before the staff even realized he had died. Now, tensions ran high among the patients, and when you have a lot of people who don't really have control over their feelings or actions, you're left to deal with the consequences. There was violent attacks between patients, there was murders, suicides, and even accidental deaths. Or at least that's what was claimed when the eggs were found to be poisoned one morning. Now, patients were also given tasks to help with occupational therapy at this hospital. This was actually common back then. There was sewing machines, looms. They helped make clothes, even though I guess they never really put them on anybody. They helped raise livestock for meat. They grew produce on the farms, and they even helped prepare meals. Well, November 1942, Assistant cook Abraham McKillop was spread a little thin with his daily tasks, and he asked his helper, patient George Nosen, to run down and grab some powdered milk so he could get caught up and keep working on other tasks. George ran down, which giving the keys to the patients was highly against the rules. When he returned, they went about preparing breakfast. Well, it didn't take long for patients to start experiencing extreme nausea, cramping in the abdomen, and this quickly turned into vomiting blood, writhing on the floor, seizures, struggling to breathe, paralysis, and some actually died just minutes after eating breakfast. Others died a little later, up to hours later, but all of them were in agony. There were bodies in the morgue. There were bodies in the chapel, in the hallways. Reports are conflicting. Some say that there were 467 patients affected. Others say it was only 263. However, 47 people died from this incident. And it was originally investigated as a mass murder. Thousands of hospitals that the food providers delivered to were tested, but they only found sodium fluoride in the eggs at Oregon State Hospital. Well, it turns out that George just got confused, went into the wrong room, and grabbed the sodium fluoride, mistaking the white powder for powdered milk. It's an honest mistake, especially if you're not fully educated on things. Now, the thing is, sodium fluoride is used in insecticides, rat and roach poison. Now, when they were going through, because November 23rd, Abraham McKillop and Mary O'Hare were arrested on manslaughter charges, and Mary O'Hare was arrested on as being an accessory. And because it was based on, well, you gave the keys, you broke the rules, this is basically falls on you, you can't really, you know, trust the patients. However, they had two different stock rooms, and one was the food items and the other was the cleaning and poison. So it just seems that George just got confused, went into the one that had the cleaning and poison, and he grabbed the wrong thing. I mean, that's, like I said, an honest mistake when you're not educated or, you know, if something's not marked properly. Now, it caused this, actually, the charges were dropped against Abraham and Mary, and it actually caused a major change in food safety reforms across the country. Now, it's sad that it took an incident like this to spark better labels and warnings, and a lot of this is where the dangerous, don't eat label comes from. But I guess, although we have to learn, because back then they, you know, they didn't know. You knew what you were doing. Only people who really handled these was who handled them. So now, sometimes the lessons aren't the easiest, but we now have higher food safety standards. Now, George Nosen actually lived out his life in the hospital until his death in 1983. He was quite the fighter and was in a lot of altercations and fistfights. And when he died, he had heart disease, but the final heart attack was brought on from an altercation with another patient. Now, the death count could have been much larger had it not been for Allie Wassel. She was a nurse who took a bite of her eggs and said it tasted a little odd. So she said it was a salty, soapy flavor. And she noped the rest of her breakfast and told the patient she was caring for, hey, don't eat it. I think something's wrong with it. Let's check. And so she actually saved lives. So good for her. Go Allie Wassel. Now, one of the survivors said that he had taken a bite and his feet became numb and his teeth actually began to ache, so he stopped eating, and that kind of saved his life. Now, the hospital is still in operation today, but runs on a much more peaceful production. There are just under 700 patients with private rooms and pods rather than the overcrowded commons it used to be. There's no more shackles. There's group therapy offered, art and music therapy, yoga and meditation is also offered. It also has a museum with relics from the past, patient possessions, antique machines, outdated treatment devices like the suppository machine from 1924, invented by a man with the last name of Applebaum. It's kind of fitting. You can also go here and learn the history of the grounds, like the facility was actually built on a former prison graveyard. You can visit the Room of Forgotten Souls that houses the cremated ashes of 3,600 patients that were cremated from 1917 to 1973. They're in these little copper urns numbered 01 to 5118. And out of that 5118, only about 1,600 were claimed. The rest were left behind. Reports of unexplained dread and the feeling of being watched are high. There are a lot of people who have come through and said they have a sense of evil that just lingers and follows them around throughout the building. The feeling that you're being followed and a heaviness sits in the air. Unexplained voices will call out. Blood is found on the walls with no explanation as to how it got there. Running footsteps can be heard in the tunnels. Screams of agony. Random laughter. Sobs can also be heard. Doors open and close on their own and items move. I'd be very surprised if that wasn't something that spirits were doing. Shadows appear only to disappear if you're turned directly to them. A Reddit commenter told of a phone call her husband had made to her while he was on lunch and he was working at the hospital, and she said that she could hear these muffled voices in the background and basically a full conversation that was kind of coming through over, and it sounded as if it was close to him. So when she mentioned it, he told her that he was in the building completely by himself, and I don't know if he noped it out of the building, but I can probably imagine he was a little spooked. Apparitions appear and move throughout the building and have been seen by multiple people. Some people have even tried to talk to them before realizing that they weren't actually there. Now, maybe these spirits are here to remind us of the chilling history that they endured. They're trying to stay relevant in a time where they were just basically forgotten about. The buildings are a silent witness to pain, suffering, and the horrors that humanity inflicts on itself. But they're also a testament to the resilience of the human spirit. And I hope that we can learn from these mistakes, learn from our histories. The ignorant approaches, it's no longer allowed to be used. We have the research, we have the information needed to understand and offer compassion and care to those suffering with their own disabilities and move forward in a progressive manner to just take care and provide treatment and healing. Now, obviously, I'm going to ask, have you visited any of these hospitals? I'd love to hear your story if you had any experiences. And even if you didn't, how was the atmosphere, the energy of the location? Is there an abandoned hospital or a haunted hospital that you'd like to hear about in a future episode? Drop it in those comments below, and I will see you next crime. You've been listening to Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces, a Pizza and Pigtails production. Created and hosted by Cassiopeia. All episodes researched, written, and edited by yours truly. Don't forget, you can find new episodes of the creepiest and spookiest content every Friday on your favorite podcast listening platform, and now YouTube as well. Subscribe to the Patreon page or the anchor.fm page for as little as $5 a month for bonus episodes every other Tuesday, a merchandise discount, and a Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces thank you swag box. You can also support without subscribing through the Cash App and Venmo. Don't forget to follow along on social media, especially the Facebook and the Instagram page at creepycases.spookyspaces for all future news and updates related to the podcast, and maybe see some content that's not featured here. Like, comment, and share with your fellow fiends to get that conversation started. And on that note, I'll see you next crime.